replied. "Have you eaten your breakfast yet, or not?"
"Yes, I have, sir."
"Then wash your dishes." It is said that as a result of this remark, the disciple was suddenly enlightened as to the whole meaning of Zen. On another occasion, a master was about to address an assembly of students when a bird began to sing in a nearby tree. The master remained silent until the bird had finished, and then, announcing that his address had been given, went away. Another master set a pitcher before two of his disciples. "Do not call it a pitcher," he said, "but tell me what it is." One replied, "It cannot be called a piece of wood." The master, however, was not satisfied with this answer, and he turned to the other disciple, who simply knocked the pitcher over and walked away. This action had the master's full approval. It will be asked whether these antics have the least connection with religion or even with ordinary sanity. They are regarded by the exponents of Zen as full of the deepest significance. And when we remember that Zen has been, beyond question, one of the most powerful influences in shaping the art and culture of the Far East, such behavior is entitled to respect. Has it some symbolic meaning? What is it about? The answer is that it has no symbolic meaning, and that it is about nothing. But it is something. And that something is that very obvious but much ignored thing, life. The Zen master is in fact demonstrating life in its actuality. Without words or ideas, he is teaching his disciples to know life directly. Sometimes, in answer to a religious question, he will give a smack on the face, returning a reality for an abstraction. If he gave a reasoned answer, the disciple would be able to analyze it, to subject it to intellectual dissection, and to imagine a mere lifeless formula as a living truth. But with a smack, a bird, a pitcher, a heap of dishes, there can be no mistake. A smack is here one moment and gone the next. There is nothing you can catch hold of, nothing other than a most lively fact, as much alive as the passing moment, which can never be made to stay. And a bird is a bird. You hear its song, but you cannot seize the notes to make them continue. It just is, and is gone. And you feel the beauty of its song precisely because the notes do not wait for you to analyze them. Therefore, the Zen master is not trying to give you ideas about life. He is trying to give you life itself, to make you realize life in and around you, to make you live it, instead of being a mere spectator, a mere pedant absorbed in the dry bones of something has long deserted. A symphony is not explained by a mathematical analysis of its notes. The mystery of a woman's beauty is not revealed by a post-mortem dissection. And no one ever understood the wonder of a bird on the wing by stuffing it and putting it in a glass case. To understand these things, you must live and move with them as they are alive. The same is true of the universe. No amount of intellectual analysis will explain it. For philosophy and science can only reveal its mechanism, never its meaning. Or, as the Chinese say,
It's Tao.
What is the Tao?
A Zen master answers, usual life is the very Tao.
How does one bring oneself into accord with it?
If you try to accord with it, you will get away from it.
For to imagine that there is a you, separate from life which somehow has to accord with life, is to fall straight into the trap. If you try to find the Tao, you are at once presupposing a difference between yourself and the Tao. Therefore, the Zen masters say nothing about the means for becoming enlightened, for understanding the Tao. They simply concentrate on Tao itself. When you are reading a book, you defeat your purpose altogether if you think about yourself trying to concentrate on it. Instead of thinking about what is written, your attention is absorbed in your efforts to concentrate. The secret is to think of your book and forget yourself. But that is not all. The book is of little use to you if you go to the other extreme and simply let it run away with you. On the contrary, you must bring your own understanding and intelligence to it, and then through the union of your own thoughts and the thoughts in the book, something new is born. This union is the important task. You must just do it and not waste energy in thinking about doing it. The same is true in Zen. It does not ask that we should so submit ourselves to life that the world altogether masters us and blots us out. There are some who never live, who are always having thoughts about life and feelings about life. Others are swept away on the tides of circumstance, so overwhelmed by events, that they have nothing of their own. Buddhism, however, is the middle way, and this is not a compromise, but a union between opposites, to produce a higher third, just as man and woman unite to produce a child. The same process is found in almost every religion, in some deeply hidden, in others plainly revealed. In Christianity, man must be born anew of water and the Spirit, symbols of substance and energy, concrete life and the mind of man. Thus the prayer to Christ to be born in us is the hope for the same enlightenment that we find in Buddhism, and the story of Christ's birth is its allegory. For the Holy Ghost is Spirit, and Mary, from the Latin mare, sea, water, is the world, called in Sanskrit Maya. And the mother of the Buddha was also called Maya. And he too was supposed to have been miraculously conceived. Thus the realization of the Christ within, the Buddha within, the Tao within, or the Krishna within, is in each instance the result of a process which Zen presents to us in this unique and almost startling manner. It is the understanding of the One which lies behind the many, the bringing together of opposites, of subject and object, the ego and the universe, to create the Holy Child. And yet we must beware of that definition, of that convenient summary of religious endeavor. It so easily becomes a mere catchphrase, a truth so fastened in a nutshell that it ceases to be of the least use. In its prison it withers away and dies. Therefore Zen comes at this stage with a most inconvenient question. when the many are reduced to the one, to what is the one to be reduced? Only he who knows what that is understands Zen. It would be futile to try to explain any further, for to do so would be to defeat the very purpose of Zen, which is to make everyone find out for himself. It is like a detective story, with the last chapter missing. It remains a mystery, a thing like a beam of light which can be seen and used, but never caught, loved, but never possessed. And by that, we may know that Zen is life. The One. The doctrines of religion are symbols used by saints and sages to describe spiritual experiences, just as ordinary men use words to describe mental and physical experiences. Students of religion recognize two kinds of spiritual experience, of which the first resembles what we call a state of mind, such as happiness, love, or fear, and the second, an experience of something outside ourselves, as when we see stars, trees, or hills. In the language of religion, the first kind of experience may be called the sense of freedom, salvation, or deliverance, and the second, a beatific vision. The doctrines of religion have their origin in attempts to convey these experiences to others by enshrining a state of mind within an idea about the universe, or by recording a vision as the basis of an article of faith. Visions are somewhat more spectacular and sensational than states of mind, and, because they have form, color, and motion, they are easier to describe. Thus, they are common in all religions, but they do not necessarily carry with them the sense of freedom, salvation, or deliverance that is the most profound, the most satisfying, and the most lasting of religious experiences. There are few who would not rather have this sense than a thousand visions. Many attempts have been made to describe the feeling of salvation, which the Buddhists call nirvana and the Hindus call moksha. Where these descriptions are in the form of doctrines, we notice that among such doctrines, there is a wide variety of differences whereby students of religion are often misled. If the doctrines of Christianity are different from those of Hinduism, it does not necessarily follow that the religions are different, for more than one doctrine may describe a single state of mind. And without this state of mind, the religion, as a mere collection of doctrines, has no meaning whatever. It is just as if it were a babble of unintelligible words. But doctrines differ because people have different mental backgrounds and traditions. An English person and a Chinese person may have the same feeling, but they will speak of it in different ways because they are relating it to different mental contexts. It is therefore most unwise to study religion from the standpoint of doctrine as doctrine, for this is the purest superficiality. Doctrines and conceptual ideas vary as languages vary, but one and the same meaning may be conveyed by both English and French. Christians believe in a personal God, and Buddhists do not. But as regards the true essentials of religion, this difference is as superficial as the fact that in French every noun has a gender, whereas this is not so in English. Therefore, to extract the true meaning of a religious doctrine, we must ask, what does this doctrine mean in terms of a state of mind? What sort of feeling towards life and the universe would have caused a man to think in this way? For religious experience is like the experience of beauty. Indeed, it is something closely akin to feeling beauty in the whole of life, instead of in a single picture, scene, image, or melody. Beethoven and Stravinsky may both arouse the sense of beauty, and they are quite as different in their own ways as Christianity and Buddhism. The important thing, however, is that they arouse that sense. We may discuss and argue over their respective merits till we are blue without coming to any conclusion. It would be more profitable, however, if we could take one who feels beauty in Beethoven and one who feels beauty in Stravinsky, and then consider the varying degrees of profundity in their respective feelings. But here we should be dealing with such intangible and imponderable factors that ordinary methods of criticism and discussion would be useless, and we could only judge by intuition. The same principle applies in religion, for the feeling of beauty in art or music is here the feeling of salvation. By this I do not mean freedom of moral conscience, nor even the certainty of an everlasting life of bliss after death, although such things may be attained by any number of different religious systems. These elementary forms of salvation have much the same relation to the deeper forms as mere sensuous thrill has to the perception of beauty. What, then, is a truly deep feeling of salvation? Insofar as this question can be answered at all, perhaps it is best to consider one of the greatest doctrines in all religion in terms of a state of mind. For this purpose, the best choice is probably the Hindu or Vedanta conception of Brahman, because this is at once the simplest and the most subtle of doctrines. Subtle, just because it is so simple. The same doctrine is found in other systems, but Vedanta gives it the best philosophical expression. It is that all possible things, events, thoughts, and qualities are aspects of a single reality, which is sometimes called the self of the universe. In themselves, these many aspects have no reality. They are real only in that each of them is a manifestation of Brahman, or the self. To put it in another way, the true self of any given thing is Brahman, and not something that belongs exclusively to the thing in question. Each individual is therefore an aspect of Brahman, and no two aspects are the same. But man's self is much more than what he considers to be his ego. His personality, called John Smith or William Jones. The ego is a device or trick, Maya, employed so that Brahman may manifest itself, and man's innermost self is therefore identical with the self of all things. Thus, if anyone wants to know what Brahman is, he has just to look around, to think, to act, to be aware, to live. For all that is known by the senses, thought in the mind, or felt in the heart, is Brahman. In other systems of thought, Brahman has many other names, Tao in Chinese, and mystics the world over find similar meaning in the words God, Allah, infinite life, élan vital, the absolute, or whatever other terms may be used. In fact, the intuition of the one reality is the essence of all mystical religion. But few people understand clearly what it is to feel this intuition in oneself. We are perhaps more apt to think of this idea just as a metaphysical speculation, a more or less reasonable theory.